You've probably seen those trucks, those catering trucks, driving up to service your plane while you're sitting on the tarmac waiting to leave. Well, thousands of those folks are low paid. They have to shell out for expensive to non-existent health insurance, and they are preparing for a possible strike to get some justice on the job. And I'll be speaking with one of the workers on today's program. I'll also dig into a new move to stop the robbery by Wall Street. Okay, true, that entire business model of Wall Street is robbery, but I'm talking today with a national expert on at least having some control over the private equity industry, which is one of the biggest pirates on Wall Street, and to try to limit that robbery. And finally, I'll also take a look at the recent minimum wage bill that passed the House and what happens next. This is Jonathan Tessini, and this is the Working Life Podcast for July 24th, 2019. As usual, a reminder, this podcast is sponsored by the American Postal Workers Union, which fights for dignity and respect on the job and decent pay and benefits and safe working conditions for its 200,000 United States Postal Service employees and retirees and nearly 2,000 private sector mail workers. You can hear this podcast everywhere on the internet's the Progressive Radio Network, Thursdays at 6 p.m., Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, you name it. Of course, beyond our major sponsor, we depend on small financial sponsors, so please do go over to workinglife.org and click on the podcast tab and look for our link to Patreon so that you can become a financial sponsor of the show and we can bring you the information that you're not going to hear from the robbers on Wall Street. So speaking of that, the Stop Wall Street Looting Act does have a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Though I'm not sure that the looting can be stopped. I mean, greed is the point after all. This is why these guys get into the industry. That doesn't mean that this bill, the Stop Wall Street Looting Act, isn't a good idea. The bill is sponsored by Senators Elizabeth Warren, Tammy Baldwin, and Sherrod Brown, and Representatives Mark Pocan and Pramila Jayapal. And they are also joined by Senators Kirsten Gillibrand, Bernie Sanders, as well as Congresspeople Barbara Lee, Jesus Chuy Garcia, Ayanna Presley, Rashida Tlaib, Jan Schakowsky, Ro Khanna, and Raul Grijalva. Surprise, surprise, no Republicans on board. Essentially, the bill is aimed right at the private equity industry. And these are the worst actors in the financial system. These are the folks who swoop in and buy up companies, load them with huge amounts of debt. They take big fees to, quote unquote, manage the company. Then they sell off a bunch of assets to further line their companies, assets like real estate, like stores. And then they walk away when inevitably a company that is loaded down with so much debt that it collapses, throwing thousands of workers into the streets with no pain or cost to the financial pirates that caused the collapse. So this bill, the Stop Wall Street Looting Act, would block and close tax and regulatory loopholes that allow private equity firms to capture all these rewards of their investments while basically insulating themselves from any risk. And lucky us, here to talk about the bill is the policy expert on private equity, in my humble opinion, and that is Eileen Applebaum. Eileen is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and she's been on the show before. You may remember the terrific discussions we've had with Eileen, and she really knows this stuff, not surprisingly, because she wrote the book on the topic, and it's called Private Equity at Work When Wall Street Manages Main Street. And as I said in the introduction, Eileen, you having the leading expertise in this area meant that Senator Warren has relied on you really principally for the economic analysis of the Stop Wall Street Looting Act. And in fact, she links directly from the press announcement, which my listeners can find by going to the official Warren Senate website, not the campaign site, but her Senate site. She links to your economic analysis, the letter you wrote to her on July 18th. And I want to use that to kind of frame our conversation. I want to start by something that really jumped out at me right away, where you write about her proposal that it would, and now I'm quoting, address the worst abuses of this business model while preserving productive investments by requiring PE firms to face accountability for their management decisions, limiting their ability to loot the companies they take over, empowering investors to fully understand private equity and other private funds, and protecting workers, customers, and other stakeholders or businesses across the country, end quote. And so in that long sentence, I kind of had the sense that your view, and I think this probably matches Senator Warren's view, is that there is a role for private equity in the economy if they behave better and they don't act like pirates and rob us, right?
Yes, I think that's accurate. One of the things to notice is that we've had a tremendous consolidation in the banking industry. And those local regional banks that medium-sized businesses used to turn to for financing really don't exist anymore. And the large banks don't have the capacity or the interest to do the kind of due diligence to make loans to these groups. So there is a role for private equity firms to come into these types of companies or even larger companies that have not figured out how to best organize their production processes, don't know how to access finance, don't know how to market nationally. This is the kind of thing that we have seen. Rose Botten and I did a book on private equity, and we saw instances in which private equity firms came in and brought their expertise about marketing channels and took a company with a local iconic brand and turned it into a national powerhouse. It was later acquired by a strategic acquirer, which means a much larger multinational that saw this as a viable department or subsidiary, and which kept the operation together as a center of excellence within the multinational. It was a really great example of how private equity can come in and provide much better information on what kind of IT systems you should have, what kind of accounting systems you should have, and how to market your products in a way that they reach a much larger customer base. And the end of the story is that everybody did well. Employment increased. The managers of the company and not the owners of the original company who had ideas about improving the technology of the product, increasing shelf life without using preservatives, never had the finance to actually implement their ideas. Private equity provided that. And that is really what made this company so attractive to a much larger multinational company, which could understand the benefits of that technology, the appeal of this product to consumers, and that does happen. That can happen. It's not infrequent, but it's an alternative to making money for the investors in private equity and for the private equity firms through financial engineering, through loading companies up with debt for which the private equity firm and the fund have no responsibility for paying it back. That type of way of dealing with the portfolio companies is just really damaging to communities and to the economy.
And one of the ways that this goes bad, if I can use a technical term, is that most of these private equity firms, and this is a thing that the Stop Wall Street Looting Act is trying to prevent, they don't have skin in the game. They basically take both the assets of the company that exist, whether it be real estate or other assets, and then they also load it up with debt, neither of which comes back as a backwash or to harm the private equity company. It's all on someone else, right?
So the problem with what is going on when you have the financial engineering is that you load all this debt onto companies. And one of the points that I make, and it's gotten even worse since I wrote the letter, is that private equity firms are overpaying for the companies they buy. There are now so many private equity firms in the market looking for companies to buy that they compete against each other. They drive the prices up and they overpay for the companies. And then they are buying. So right now they're buying companies at around 12 times earnings. In the first quarter of this year, when I wrote the letter, it was only 11 something times earnings. Now we're up to 12 times earnings. This is huge. I mean, typically you buy a company at 6 or 7 times earnings with the idea that you will sell it later at 8 times earnings and make a profit. you buy companies at 12 times earnings, it is going to be difficult. And the investors, the pension funds and other investors need to know, which they don't seem to recognize, that if the private equity funds are paying overpaying for the companies, it's going to be hard to exit at a profit, much less at the kind of profit they want. But they overpay, so we have this high payment, and then they load the companies. Now it's close to seven, the debt part is close to seven times earnings. Anything over six times earnings has been flagged by the organizations that regulate the banks as really very dangerous in terms of leading to financial distress. So they're overpaying, they're loading up with debt, and now what happens is that the portfolio company has to pay the interest on the debt. They also have these agreements between the private equity firm and the portfolio company in which they pay the private equity firm special management fees. They pay transaction fees anytime the firm buys additional companies to load, combine with them into a platform. All the merger and acquisition activity that you see in the private equity space is not paid for by private equity firms. It's paid for by the portfolio companies. This takes resources out of these companies and hollows them out. And even if they don't go bankrupt, and most do not go bankrupt, but they are not really in a good position to serve their customer markets, to make returns for investors, and to treat their workers fairly.
So is it a sign that is a red flag when you see a private equity company pay 10 or 11 or 12 times earnings because they're betting on the fact, the reason they're paying a lot of money, they're betting on the fact that mostly they're going to figure out how to strip the company, sell its assets, say like real estate, and then of course pay themselves all these fees that you point out. So essentially they're overpaying because they're betting on the fact that they're going to pay themselves no matter what happens to the company, even if it collapses later, right?
That is absolutely true. So what we can see is that it's the rare case in which a private equity firm doesn't make money, regardless of how the portfolio company performs. My line is that the house never loses. The private equity firm always makes its money back. They take it out in dividends. And so you will notice that Warren's bill restricts their ability to pay themselves dividends in the first 2 years. They take it out in the form of these management fees and transaction fees. And one of the things for investors, they are not, no investor in a private equity firm has a right to information, in one of these funds has a right to information about the fees that the companies that they own that are in that portfolio are paying to the private equity firm, not to the fund, but to the firm. These are direct agreements. So even if you made everything transparent that goes on within the private equity fund, no limited partner in that fund, meaning the pension funds and other investors, would have any information about these special monitoring fees and transaction fees that are being paid directly to the private equity firm. So one of the things that Warren has done is she wants to make all of these payments transparent. You should know as an investor to what extent the companies you own are being hollowed out by the private equity firm that took your money to manage it to make those investments. What's the probability you're actually going to end up making any money on all of this? And what's the probability that the companies that you've invested in with the promise that private equity would make them better will actually turn out to be hollowed out and unable really to be as productive as they could have been otherwise.
Now, one of the things you point out also in your letter, and this really dovetails with something people are chattering about out there, is the threat to another financial crisis down the road, perhaps even next year. And Senator Warren kind of foreshadowed that recently. And in your letter, you talked about how this leveraged lending market has just grown dramatically. And principally, that's because private equity is trying to collect all this money and they are leveraging companies. They have to go get that money from somewhere. And it's gone from 20% in 2018 and is now $1.2 trillion. To compare that for my listeners, it was only I say kind of sarcastically, $600 billion at the time of the last financial crisis. So it's essentially twice that amount now. Now, the thing that you make the interesting distinction here is between like a financial collapse, which people are murmuring about, versus the collapse of very specific companies, which is really important too, because that affects thousands of workers' livelihood, communities who all of a sudden don't have a company around there that's spending the money. Workers are not around spending the money. So you make the distinction between, in some way, I think, let's not focus on this big calamity of this massive financial collapse, but it's still really bad.
That is really right, because I don't really think that the leverage lending, big as it is going to lead to the kind of financial crisis we saw in 2008 or even a collapse of the corporate bond market. So what you have to pay attention to is how low interest rates are. And the interest rate burden of all of the corporate debt, not the leveraged lending part alone, but if you look at all corporate debt, the interest rate burden is actually quite low. It's not higher than it was historically, despite the big increase in corporate debt of all kinds. But the thing about leveraged loans is that the assumptions underlying them all have to come true in order for those loans to pay off. And that is unlikely to happen. A slowing economy, we don't need a recession. A slowdown in the economy as a result of Trump's trade war, for example, this will cause some of those leveraged loans to go bad. And the more we have economic problems beginning to develop short of a recession, you will see more and more of these leveraged loans going bad. They are one-way bets. We have made the set of assumptions. If they all come true, the company will be able to pay its debts and survive long enough for us to sell it to somebody else and get out of here. So it won't go bankrupt in private equity hands. That really depends on everything going the way it was assumed to go. And that includes an assumption about how the economy is going to grow and develop. And if there is an economic slowdown, then all of these companies with leverage loans will be in danger. And those in which the leverage is the highest and the demand is most cyclical will see the biggest impact. So you see private equity trying to get out of consumer goods now.
Yes.
They don't want to be in restaurants and retail because they know that's the first place that a downturn or even a slowdown in the economy is going to hurt them.
And you were telepathic because the next question I was going to ask you relates directly to retail, and it reinforces the point you make about in some way it's specific areas that are going to be threatened if the slowdown hurts them. And retail, number one, has been hurt by Amazon and other factors, not just private equity. But you point out, and this really, again, blew me away, private equity firms own only a fraction of U.S. retail chains, but a disproportionate share of them end up in retail bankruptcies like Toys R Us, Payless Shoes, PetSmart, Radio Shack, Staples, Sports Authority. So you could have a similar situation that there's not a whole financial collapse, but a bunch of sectors that are affected, as you point out, by trade wars or other things will keel over because of the debt load of the private equity folks.
Right. That is the exact point. There may not be a recession, but there will be pain. And you put your finger on it.
So yeah. The last question is, maybe this is a political question. What are the chances that this would become law, given that number one, in the United States Senate, as I like to say, there are two words, Mitch McConnell, that essentially prevent any restraint on corporations and certainly not on private equity. And then you've got a president, obviously, who's not interested in this. So essentially, this is a document, a position being taken for, in some way, the future.
Well, let's go back and think about the fight for 15 when Bernie Sanders first proposed a $15 minimum wage. And everybody said, oh, that could never pass. That will never happen. That's just ridiculous. People should be able to live on 7 1/4 an hour. What's wrong with those people? And now you couldn't be more mainstream than asking for $15 minimum wage. You have Amazon asking for a $15 minimum wage. You have Walmart wanting to see that nationally. So you just have no idea where these things go. Ideas that right now seem like, oh my God, how could they ever pass, become mainstream when people face the reality. So if we do in fact have companies. You listed a whole bunch of companies that have already either faced financial distress, and some of them have faced liquidation. I mean, Shopko has just been closed, if you're from the Midwest. More of that, and wait and see how popular this legislation becomes.
As you heard in the introduction, thousands of catering workers for airlines are gearing up to strike. This industry, the airline industry, is rolling in dough. In 2018, to give you one stat, American, Delta, and United made a combined profit, get this, of $7.4 billion. American, on its own, reported a 2018 profit of $1.9 billion, but the wages for catering workers, and those are workers who are actually subcontracted workers who prepare and pack and deliver that in-flight food and beverages, you know, the filet mignon that you get in Main Economy. Those workers in American Airlines' major hub cities remain the lowest paid in the country in that industry. Now, a little wonkiness here. Workers in the airline industry fall under something called the National Railway Labor Act, and that means that before striking, the union needs to petition something called the National Mediation Board for the right to strike after a 30-day so-called cooling-off period, a period during which the board tries to see if the parties can work the issues out before the workers walk out. But it's also, frankly, used as a process to undercut union pressure. But that's a story for another time. Thousands of union members, however, have already authorized the strike should the cooling off period not produce a fair deal. So here to talk about the fight for a decent wage at the airport catering companies is a catering worker, Stephanie Kopnang, who works for LSG Sky Chefs in the airline's main Dallas-Fort Worth hub. Stephanie earns $10.85 an hour at this job. And Stephanie, maybe the first thing that would be interesting to my listeners would be to ask you how you got into this job. Where did you find this job and why did you choose to start working at the LSG Sky Chefs?
I choose to work on LSG Sky Chefs because I'm an immigrant. I first got in this country. Most of us over there do not speak English. The language is a problem. Like, we have a language barrier. So Sky Chef kind of take everybody there, actually. So that's how I get there. Mm-hmm.
And you came from Cameroon to Texas, right? How did you end up in
Texas? Yes.
Why did you choose Texas to immigrate to? Did you have family there?
Yes, I immigrated to Texas because I have my uncle living there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did you immigrate with family or children, or are you on your own?
On my own.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about what your job is like at the company. You know, you wake up, you come in, your shift starts when, and what do you do there?
I actually work overnight. My shift started at 3:30 to 12. I work in assembly. I assemble all the soda and cookies, and napkin and coffee for American Airlines flying, leaving the next morning. That's what I do there.
And you said, I think you said you work in assembly. So you mean you pull it all together so when they deliver to the planes, everything is correct and right?
Yes. Yes.
And so it's you basically breakfast, right? Or things, the little snacks they hand you out.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's actually what we did. Mm-hmm.
Do you like the work?
Right now, I do like it because it helped me to pay my bill. But the conditions are really bad.
And so describe the bad conditions which are leading to this big protest. And all over, I want to remind my listeners, this is happening all over the country. Thousands of workers are preparing to strike if the conditions are not improved. So describe a little bit about the conditions that are difficult for you in terms of the pay and anything else.
We work there. Most of my coworkers work overtime on a daily basis to be able to survive. because the pay is really bad. I worked there almost 4 years now. I'm getting to 4 years, and my pay is $10.85. The lowest pay go up to $9.85 for other people in our kitchen. And for this, I have a coworker who has been working there for 29 years. She's making $12.75 per hour.
That's crazy.
And the bad thing is, working for $9.85, the health insurance on the week, we get it paid on a weekly basis. Every week, for a single person, you have to pay the health insurance for $51 every week. Or if you have a family plan, you have to pay $124 every week. That's actually how bad it is.
And if you just do the math on that, just taking into account the health insurance that cost every week out of your paycheck, that leaves you very little money, I assume, at the end of the week and certainly at the end of the month to pay the rest of your bills like rent and utilities and food.
That's what it is. And we all realize everything around us, like rent, that all our bills that we're talking of here, I keep going up, but our wages still staying low. The airline industry that we are talking about here are making a lot of profit, a lot of profits in this last 5 years. They are almost a $50 billion benefit, but we still have nothing. We still have the low wages. How can that happen? Mm-hmm.
And so when you work your shift from 3 to midnight, you try to get even overtime hours, I assume, just to be able to increase your paycheck, right?
Yes. So actually, our schedule is five days a week, but we actually find ourselves working 7 days a week, double shift. Means we come in at 6 o'clock in the morning to go home at 12.
Right. So the overtime that you get, is that forced overtime, or is the overtime so necessary that everybody is happy to work these crazy double shifts and essentially be exhausted at the end of the day just to make ends meet?
Nobody is happy to work overnight, to work overtime. Nobody is happy. But just because you have to make it at the end of the month, when you are looking for, like, the rent is waiting for me, the insurance is waiting for me, this is waiting for me. So you look at all those bills. You have to push yourself. I have a lot of coworkers coming at work sick. I even have two of them who passed out on the shop floor.
Wow.
They died on the shop floor just because they were so tired. Blood pressure went up. They couldn't make it.
So you're based in the Dallas hub, which I think most people know is a place that American Airlines has been for many, many years. They've invested a lot of money specifically in upgrading that entire operation there, and yet they haven't really thought about including you in that upgrade, meaning your workers, the people who, without whom they could not run the airline. Is that a sense of you're thinking that, especially in that area, especially in Dallas, you really need to have the improvements?
Yes, we do really need improvement in Dallas, on the special on the kitchen and the workers that are working in there, because we are just living there and working paycheck by paycheck and living paycheck by paycheck. So that's not really fair for a company like American Airlines. They have to treat us the same way that they treat the other worker. We are still part of that. I'm sure 100% when we talk about airline industry, most of the people seeing the flight attendants, the pilots, the baggage handler, and all those people over there, but they can't really see the people down the stairs who do the job. I always ask this question. How many of us can travel without food or drink or coffee in the plane? I always have the answer, none of us. But do you know how that's for get made? It get made by us who get paid $9.85 to do that job. Who get sick and come to work. Who we have a coworker who die on the job because they have to be able to make it. And that's not really fair. So American Airlines have to look up of our situation. They can fix that. They have the power to do it.
And describe any other instances of your coworkers in terms of the ability to pay their bills. I assume that, and you don't have to disclose anything personal or private, but I assume you end up going into debt just to pay your bills. And is that the same with your coworkers, especially those who have children that they have to take care of?
That's the reason why all of us have stand up now and say we are fed up. Enough is enough. We will not take it no more. At this time, we are ready to go to do everything that it takes to be able to live decent, actually. That's the reason why the last month we have been taking a strike vote all around the country. And up to now, we have 11,000 workers who have voted for to strike when released by the MNA. LMB, we have 11,000 workers who are ready to strike when released. Mm-hmm.
You all are preparing to strike when the government properly releases you and gives you the ability to do that.
We are asking them for release tomorrow. That's one of the reasons why we are doing this big action tomorrow. And this will not be the last. We have another big action to Dallas. Dallas, where I come from in Texas, where we're going to be doing the picket in front of American Airlines and going to the airport just to ask them to release us to strike because we are fed up. Enough should be enough. And tell them one job should be enough.
One job should be enough. That's an important slogan that Unite Here is certainly promoting. And one of the things that is also on the agenda, and we're talking about this in this episode as well, is the notion that here we just had a vote in the United States Congress to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which has been, as you probably know, a slogan and a campaign that Unite Here and others have taken part in for many years. So it's been successful. And here, the $15 an hour is where you're reaching for, and yet you're being paid a lot less than that.
Yes.
And these companies are making a ton of money.
That's right. And Dallas too, is an American town. That's where they have their headquarters. So they actually have to do what it takes.
And again, what really struck me, although you are working there relatively new as a worker, 4 years, you said, you have somebody that you know who's worked there 29 years, so has shown their loyalty to the company, and yet they're only making $12.25, which is still a poverty wage when you do the math, when you take into account the healthcare costs, the cost of rent, the cost of utility, $12.25 an hour is not a wage that someone can live comfortably on.
That's right. That's the reason why we are saying one job should be enough for any worker in the category.
Mm-hmm. And you sense among your workers that the people who have voted to authorize going on strike at the proper time, you think there's a sense of great solidarity and unity to do that at the time that that happens?
Yes, we are united.
Last but not least, I wanted to have a bit of a dive into the minimum wage bill that just passed the House, and you probably read about that. This is a good thing. I mean, we have to have some rosy news on this podcast. We can't just be doom and gloom. The bill would hike the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2025. Now, this is terrific, and it also shows how deeply workers have been robbed year after year. I mean, the minimum wage hasn't been raised since 2009, but if we really looked at productivity over the past, say, three decades, the minimum wage bill that just passed should actually call for a wage over $20 an hour. So as good as this victory is, it should only be seen by all of us as a down payment on getting wages to where wages should be, given how hard people work. And remember this, even at $15 an hour, if you take out your handy calculator, if someone is working a full week, 52 weeks a year, 40 hours a week, that's only $31,200 at jobs that have no pension and meager, if any, health coverage. So $15 an hour is not enriching people. To chat with me about the minimum wage bill, it's great to welcome back Judy Conte, the Government Affairs Director of the National Employment Law Project. And before we talk about some of the specifics, Judy, about this really great step that's been taken out to finally raise the minimum wage after a decade that it's been stuck where it is, and it'll be actually more than a decade once it's implemented, I assume you would recognize that really this comes about, this whole passage, as a result of incredible activism on the part of the Fight for 15 movement, unions, your organization, and other organizations. I mean, there was great grassroots mobilization that forced this on the table, right?
Absolutely. I mean, all of us are standing on the shoulders of giants right now. And those giants are the workers from the Fight for 15, who are the members of the Restaurant Opportunity Center, who are affiliated with networks across the country, such as the Center for Popular Democracy and the Working Families Organization and People's Action. All of these are workers who put their own livelihoods on the line to some degree. I mean, they've walked out of their jobs and gone on economic strikes because what they're being paid just isn't enough to survive. They're speaking up and they're organizing in their communities. And they are really the force that created the impetus to finally get this bill onto the floor and through the House of Representatives by a really, really strong vote. So there's groups like NELP that do great policy work and lobbying and all of that behind the scenes, and the Economic Policy Institute that provides us with all of the analysis we need to show why this is the right thing to do. But as hard as we all work, none of this would have happened without the workers taking the lead.
And I think some of this activism goes directly to the political question, which you and I are going to talk a lot about in this discussion. It goes to the reality that the reason this passed was the Democrats retook the House in the last election, in the midterm elections in 2018. And I'm going to guess that thousands of people were motivated, especially these activists within the Fight for 15 and unions, to go out and work in those political campaigns in those districts that were important for the takeover. And they were motivated by, among other things, obviously there were other issues, but certainly this was centerpiece for many people, right?
Absolutely. When you look at exit polls in the last election, you see what turned the tide. As much as opposition to the current state of affairs was the desire for a real progressive economic agenda, one that put working people first, one that raised wages, that cut back on unpaid overtime, that made sure people had health care. You know, all of these pocketbook issues are so important for folks. And, you know, my friends who work at unions will tell you they had members out canvassing like never before because they understood how high the stakes were. And they understood that they had the power to return the House to people who would take actions like this, that would vote for a $15 minimum wage gradually implemented, who would make sure that the Paycheck Fairness Act got passed, who would stand up for organizing rights, who would stand up for health care. So I think the House did a great job delivering on a very central promise of its campaign and showed what it's capable of doing.
And I don't want to gloss over the undercard or the sub-story, which is very important, is the elimination of the tipped wages, which was just kind of an outrage. I mean, I did my time, if I can use that terminology, as a waiter myself, and I was being paid a low minimum wage, but that was many years ago. And here you have people, and it's not just about waiters, obviously, it's all sorts of people who survive on tips, but that's impossible to survive on.
Absolutely. People who work for tips will tell you they get a paycheck for $0.00 because all of their taxes are taken out of it. And what's left is whatever they take home that week in tips. And some weeks may be great. Others may be awful. There's an ebb and flow. And a lot of, I think people make the mistake of assuming that a lot of tipped workers are in higher end restaurants and making really great tips. you know, the average hourly wage of tipped workers is somewhere in the $950-$960 range, which isn't anywhere close to what even an individual needs to survive and to be able to support themselves. And there are so many, and remember, that's the average. So for every person that you hear the National Restaurant Association talking about making, you know, $50, $60, $70 an hour in tips, that is then balanced out by the vast majority of people who work for diners and small mom and pops and places where, you know, they're barely getting minimum wage per hour.
Yes, and I remember that personally. I worked in what you'd call a mid-level kind of hamburger restaurant. It certainly wasn't high-end. And at the time, it was not bad money, but I remember thinking I was working my butt off and certainly not becoming rich from it. Now, I was much younger and I could survive on that a little bit. But still, as you point out in the information you put out, that the people who are going to benefit from this, and this is one of the misnomers, that this is somehow minimum wage jobs or these entry level jobs, they're teenager jobs, they're summer jobs. 30.1 million adults age 20 or older are going to benefit from this bill.
Exactly. About 10% of the people who make at or near the minimum wage in this country are teenagers. It is working adults. The average age creeps up every year. It's about 34 or 35 right now. And, you know, it's not a starting wage either, because especially in rural parts of the country where there only are a few big employers, like a Walmart or a McDonald's or some other fast food institution, they can really set and depress wages for everybody there. So people will keep making low wages year after year after year, even though they've got longevity in the job, even though they've got increased productivity, even though they've shown their loyalty. The employers can just do it because they can, because there's no upward pressure from strong minimum wage policy. And it's just really unconscionable that we allow that to keep happening.
And very much to your point, I remember doing some work on another issue in West Virginia and talking to coal miners in several communities. And one of the reasons that they're very concerned, obviously, about the shutdown of the mines is if you lose that unionized coal mining job, then there's nothing else but the job at the dollar store or the 7-Eleven, which, as you point out, is paying a minimum wage. And you can't raise a family on that.
Absolutely not. There is no place in this country today where you can even support yourself by any minimum standard on $7.25 an hour, let alone support a family. Indeed, according to the Economic Policy Institute's family wage calculator, they estimate that in the cheapest cost of living places in this country, you would need about $13 an hour to just support yourself all alone, no dependents. And that roughly equates to about what 15 would be in 2024. So when we're talking about raising the minimum wage to $15 over the stretch of time that we are discussing, it really is, it seems like such a big increase because we've kept minimum wages so depressed in this country, but really we're barely even getting to the margins of self-sufficiency for one person in the cheap cost of living places in this country.
And let's add to that something that I've said on this podcast many, many times, that we're only beginning to get anywhere close to what the minimum wage should be, which is roughly 20 or above $20 an hour, if you take into account productivity over the last 30 years. So this is only partially restoring what I, and I'm sure you would agree with this, consider the robbery of people's sweat over the past three decades.
Absolutely. And as we see huge corporations making record profits and really just sitting on a lot of them, not even investing in research and development, certainly not giving raises to the workers who have enabled them to make so much money, it's just really immoral. And it's time that our federal minimum wage policy put an end to it.
Now, here's something I want to circle back to the conversation, the wonderful conversation I had last week with your colleague, Laura Weiser, on the preemption attacks that are happening at the state level by corporate America. And you well know this. I'm just going to remind my listeners of this reality, and people can go back and listen to this great conversation I had last week in our archive, that half the states today now prevent localities from passing minimum wage laws. So the corporate right wing, supported by their Chamber of Commerce allies, they went into many states, convinced legislators to basically prevent cities and others from raising their own minimum wages. And I raise that only to point out how important raising the federal minimum wage is. Lots of people are familiar with, oh, you know, my city just raised the minimum wage. Why do we need to do it at the federal level? Well, the fact is that in at least half the states, people aren't going to have that advantage unless we raise it at the federal level.
Exactly. And right now there are 21 states that are stuck at $7.25 an hour. And really there's only one or two, if there's a flip in the legislature, where there's any realistic hope of that changing absent federal legislation. You know, the whole preemption thing I find so ironic. The response of the Chamber of Commerce and many of the more conservative in this country is we shouldn't have a federal minimum wage. It should all be left to the states. They, localities know where the best way to take care of their people and set their wages and set their benefits. Yet when the true localities, cities and counties, try to do the same thing, it's the conservatives that rush in and say, no, 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 this, only the state can do this, not you. So there's a real hypocrisy in that kind of response to minimum wage as well.
I'm shocked, shocked hypocrisy when it comes when it comes to the corporate rhetoric and the right-wing rhetoric when it comes to helping workers. I'm shocked, shocked. So let's use our last couple of minutes here to talk about the reality of the politics here. And you and I talked about this a little bit offline, so I'm not surprising you with this question. So it's fantastic that this has passed the House, but now it goes to where all good things die, thanks to two words that I hate to even mutter, which are Mitch McConnell.
Mitch McConnell.
And so is this just then a political statement that our side, progressives, are going to be using in the coming election, given the reality that there's a Senate that's going to stop it, probably, and hopefully you'll tell me that I'm wrong about that. And then there's a guy in the Oval Office who will never sign this.
Right. Well, look, I never say never. But that being said, what we and the coalition and the Fight for 15 plan on doing is not letting anybody sit comfortably by and just ignore this. We are going to take this to the Senate. We are going to be working in states, in localities, in districts, you know, grassroots organizations across the country, including the Fight for 15. And we're going to make sure that if people don't come to the table to talk about minimum wage and in good faith work on trying to get minimum wage increased across the country, that there's going to have to be a political price that they pay for that. And I say that across the board, whether people are Democrats or Republicans. This is too important an issue for people to just sit back and do nothing. I mean, people are dying out there because they can't get medications. They don't have health care. You know, we know that when you raise the minimum wage, health care, especially for women and children, and, you know, health care outcomes increase, suicides decrease, you know, educational attainment for children of parents making more money is better. I mean, there's just every good reason to raise the minimum wage. And we're going to make sure in an election year that, you know, through, you know, organizations that can engage in political activity are going to make sure that people know who's on their side and who's not. We're not going to go quietly on this by any stretch of the imagination. We'll use it to continue to press further action in state and localities as well. And we're going to make sure that everybody in the Senate who refuses to come to the table and work on raising the minimum wage feels the heat for doing that.
And the last question I'd say to follow up on this, I mean, this should be a no-brainer for the Democrats who are leading the races, especially in the Senate, in those so-called swing states, to use the minimum wage as a real cudgel and a real thing to lobby on. Because let's face it, to your point about it doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican, or I'll add an independent, I mean, those millions of people that we talked about, the 30.1 million adults, that's people of every single party. And you would think those kinds of voters, those so-called swing voters who are across the political spectrum, are the very people you could reach with the message about the minimum wage and to show who's opposing giving you a few extra dollars in your pocket.
I think it's a winning issue across the board. I would be amazed if people don't run on their support for minimum wage and for raising it. We did in March, NELP did a polling of 57 swing districts in the House, and found 65% support for a $15 minimum wage. So this is the right thing to do from a public policy point of view, and it's the right thing to do from a political point of view.
That'll do it for this week's podcast. Thanks to my guests, Eileen Applebaum, Stephanie Kopnang, and Judy Conti. Our audio editor, as usual, is David Hebden. Thanks to our sponsor, the American Postal Workers Union. Please do subscribe and support this podcast. You can do that by going over right now to workinglife.org, clicking on the podcast tab, and finding your way over to Patreon. Thanks for listening. Look forward to having you back next week.